This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier this month, E. Jean Carroll won an unprecedented legal victory. In a civil suit, Donald Trump was found liable for sexual abuse against her in the mid-90s and for defamation in accusing her of trying to pull off a hoax. But no sooner was that decision announced that the former president turned around and repeated his attack, using the same sort of defamatory insults that we've heard and grown so used to over the years. And he played it for laughs in his recent live interview on CNN.
What kind of a woman meets somebody and brings them up, and within minutes you're playing hanky-panky in a dressing room, okay?
E. Jean Carroll has now filed an amended complaint based on Trump's continued statements about the case. I spoke with Carroll along with her attorney, Roberta Kaplan, who is known for her work on sexual violence. So on May 9th, Donald Trump was found liable for sexual abuse and defamation in your suit against him. And not a day later, in Trump's inimitable fashion, he called you a whack job. And he made fun of you about what had happened to you during a CNN town hall broadcast around the world. Tell me about watching that or experiencing that and what you felt.
Well, David, the happiest day of my life was on May 9th. Robbie and I stood in that courtroom and heard nine jurors respond that we had been telling the truth. And the moment of joy was so incredible. It was like a new world had opened up to me. And I think Robbie sort of felt the same. We were both just ascending. We have a great evening. We walk back into the office. Champagne is flying. Music is playing. We are literally dancing at tears of joy flying out of people's eyes. The next day, we are just getting used to being so happy in a new world. And I was so tired from being happy, I was in bed when CNN started with the former president. And Robbie sent me the transcript of what Trump had said. And it was a plunge from the heights down to the depth. It was an amazing experience. I mean, the ride down was so swift and so sure.
You know, it's easy to make an assumption that in the Me Too era, certainly since the Harvey Weinstein reporting and so on, which, by the way, Robbie Kaplan knows quite a bit about these cases, that people take sexual assault more seriously, and yet you heard this laughter in the crowd, and then you read what you read on Twitter. Now, life is not Twitter, and the full population of the United States was not in that room with Donald Trump, but it is numerous Were you surprised by the reaction?
I was stunned by the reaction because it was not a slap against me. It was a slap against almost every single woman who was hearing him. Every woman who's just been merely pinched or grabbed, and then the guy laughs and denies it. Every woman hearing him saying those terrible things about me, I'm sure they felt as they were hurt like I was.
Now, Robbie Kaplan, you have filed an amendment to a separate defamation lawsuit that's still pending. Can you explain where we are legally?
Yeah, it's complicated, so let me try to do it as simply as I can, David. When E. Jean wrote her book and an excerpt from it was published in New York Magazine, Trump responded almost immediately with what we call a three-day defamation rampage. Kind of classic Trump. He ramped up the rhetoric each day, saying crueler and more vicious things. And those were the statements that we originally sued him for defamation about. That case, which is just limited to that defamation, we filed in the fall of 2017. And because he made those statements as president, let me withdraw that. I would not say he made them as president. Because his job was president when he made those statements, it's gotten wrapped up in some very complicated technical issues about whether or not the Department of Justice should be the proper defendant, whether the case should be dismissed because you can't sue a sitting president for something he does as president for defamation, et cetera. And it's been on kind of a Dickensian 3-year path through the federal court system. And it's still pending. And that case is now before Judge Kaplan. The second case, which we call affectionately call Carol 2, which was the case that was just tried, that was for the underlying assault, because New York passed a law that allowed women now to sue for assaults that happened outside the statute of limitations. And two, classic Trump, during the course of the case in October of last year, he made another defamatory statement, and we added that to the case. So that's the case that was just tried, and we reached the verdict in. It was the underlying assault, which the jury said was $2 million in damages, and the 2022 defamation, which the jury said was $3 million in damages. But we still have Carol 1, and if you think about it, it makes sense. That's where the damages are highest, because that's the first time he said this stuff about her. That's when it really damaged her reputation. That's when she lost her job.
That was an advice column in Elle magazine that was discontinued.
Yeah. And so that's the case we want to go forward with before Judge Kaplan. And now we say we also, in that case, get punitive damages now because he kept on doing it. If anything, it's hard to imagine something that would better justify punitive damages than the defendant continuing to engage in the tort.
Robbie, what sort of timeline can we expect as this moves forward? Do you expect this to also go before a jury?
Yeah, but it will only go before jury, as I said before, on damages. So the question about whether Donald Trump's statements are defamatory, that's now been decided. He can't relitigate that. But a jury will be able to decide damages.
Now, there are some people that ask, why pursue legal action? Do you think that it's ever going to change Donald Trump? How will this move the needle, either societally or where it comes to Donald Trump, who's now the front runner in the presidential race on the Republican side for 2024?
Well, I'm no political expert, so I can't speak to the politics of it. I can say things that I think we proved by a preponderance, but I think even by a higher standard in this trial. One is that Trump is a liar. He lied about Eugene. He's done it now several times. He continues to do it. And he has a pattern in which he lies, the way in which he lies, which is he gets more vicious and more resolute and nastier over time. And we saw that in terms of the three defamations now, or the three different times he's defamed Eugene. I'm sure they'll continue before we get to a jury again. And the jury saw that. They saw the videotape of his deposition where he was clearly lying, and they concluded that he was a liar. One of the things I said in my closing argument is in order for Trump to win here, you have to believe that he's the only one telling the truth, and that the 11 witnesses that Eugene put on, they are all lying. Well, we know which way the jury came out. They concluded that Eugene and the 10 other witnesses were telling the truth and that Trump was the liar.
Eugene, I have to ask you, one of the more famous quotations by Donald Trump in the beginning of his presidential campaign was that even if he shot somebody on Fifth Avenue, he could get away with it. Maybe I'm paraphrasing it, but that's more or less the quote. Do you think that era has ended with this decision in court?
I think we're ending it. And now, it's just not Robbie Kaplan, me, and the nine jury. I think people are starting to recognize that when Donald Trump defames someone, or when Donald Trump lies, people tend to believe it and they act on it. So hence, they attacked the Capitol when he said he won the election. They attacked me because he said I'm a liar and that, you know, the horrible things. And Robbie Kaplan has figured out the one way to stop him is to make him pay for lying. And if he were made to pay for shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue, I don't think he would have shot him. Money is precious to him. And Robbie is going to go get some of his money for his lying.
So what you're saying is that this is his moment of comeuppance.
I think it just may be.
Now, Trump did not appear in the courtroom in the last trial, and his lawyer did not call a single witness. Robbie, how unusual is that, and how do you think that might have affected the verdict?
It's unbelievably unusual, David. In a civil case, I don't think I've ever had a civil case where no one from the defendant shows up. I think we all know why he didn't show up here, because I think he thought, and his lawyers definitely told him, he would be in worse trouble if he showed up. But to have an empty seat at the defense table is unprecedented, at least in my lifetime, and the jury definitely saw that. Eugene, in great contrast, testified, I think it was for almost 2.5 to 3 days, calmly and unbelievably patiently took questions that were really, really hard to answer. Mm-hmm. And so the contrast between her standing up there, sitting up there, having taken an oath, patiently answering Joe Tacopino's questions, and Trump not showing up, and then the only way they saw him was on video when I deposed him at Mar-a-Lago, and he spent a lot of the video just insulting both me and Eugene, the contrast could not have been clearer.
You were referring to her physical looks, correct?
Just the overall. I look at her, I see her, I hear what she says, whatever. You wouldn't be a choice of mine either, to be honest with you. I hope you're not insulted. I would not, under any circumstances, have any interest in you. I'm honest when I say it. She, I would not have any interest in.
Do you think, Robbie, that that Donald Trump, considering his history, will follow the judge's instructions and amp down the rhetoric directed at Eugene? Because it doesn't seem so.
No, I mean, not in the near term. I don't think he will. I don't think he can help himself, honestly. I don't think he has enough frontal lobe development in the frontal lobe of his brain to do that. On the other hand, the one thing, as Eugene said, he understands his money. And at some point, he'll understand that every time he does it, it's going to cost him a few million dollars. And that may make a difference.
Although a few million dollars is a trivial sum for him.
Well, that's what he says. We'll see. I'm not sure that he's got millions of dollars liquid lying around to pay the judgment here.
While Donald Trump continues to trash talk you in the ugliest way imaginable, he's been fundraising off of the judgment in this lawsuit. What does that say about the country you live in?
Well, I love this country. I love how the federal court worked. I loved how the jury worked. I love it. I hate to be all positive about this, but I think we've made a difference. I really do. I really feel it. And I don't care what a blowhard he is and says all those terrible things. I think we're convincing people. I really do, David.
His poll numbers continue to thrive.
And there's a certain segment of the society that, listen, a lot of people don't like women. There's a lot of women haters in this country. I hate to go this route, but you're, and if there's any little thing that Robbie and I and the nine members of the jury can do defending our truth and letting people know that, yes, Donald Trump is a liar, and he dragged me through the mud, and he ground my face into the dirt, and yes, it happened. I think we can turn just enough women and men at the polls to make sure he doesn't become the next president.
I'm anyone who knows me would not tell you that I'm someone who's known for my unbridled optimism, to say the least. But there was one thing about this case that was very hopeful to me, probably the most hopeful thing, and that is, and Trump, it's another thing he lies about this. This was not a avocado toast eating jury. We had six men and three women. We had one person from the Bronx, one person from Manhattan. All the rest were from north of Westchester. All nine jurors unanimously hearing the evidence in a court of law according to the rules and with a judge who applied the rules fairly found what they found. Now, the trick here is the world in social media, as you pointed out, David, is not a courtroom with the rules of evidence. And so I don't know how to kind of expand that out. But it was very hopeful to me that this particular jury, which is, you know, not a New York City jury at all, not no one from Brooklyn, it just wasn't a New York City jury, that they found and that they and it only took them 2.5 hours. That was probably the most shocking part of it to me.
Now, Ejin, you're pretty frank about your political distaste for Donald Trump and wanting to see him defeated. And one could hardly blame you on any level for saying that. But I have to ask you, Robbie, does that present you a problem as a lawyer?
Well, so one of the arguments that they made in the case, in fact, their main defense in this case, and it's because they didn't have a better one, is that E. Jean, Lisa Birnbach, her friend, who she told at the time, who's a journalist, Carol, who wrote the Preppy Handbook, Carol Martin, who was a TV journalist for many years here in New York City, that they all got together at some point because they hate Trump so much that they decided to make up this lie about something that had happened in 1996 and really hatch a conspiracy to bring him down. And none of our witnesses, and we were very open about this, not a single one of our witnesses was a fan of Donald Trump's, politically or for any other reason, but that didn't change the fact that they were all telling the truth. And so I think the jury, I'm not sure, I don't know to this day whether any of the jurors voted for Donald Trump. I'm pretty confident that they are all, some of them probably like things about Donald Trump. But when they saw the evidence and when they saw the witnesses taking an oath and testifying there on the witness stand, they believed them and they did not believe that they were just willing to go and kind of lie and help E. Jean and hatch his conspiracy just because they didn't like Donald Trump as president.
Ejin, I have to ask, no matter how the rest of this case goes, whether there are damages recovered or not, I want to ask about your life now. How's your life changed after the verdict, and how do you go on? What's it going to be like?
Well, I just adopted a new dog, a Great Pyrenees, the most moral of all dog breeds, the most moral, just the most wonderful dog. She's right here, Miss Havisham, Sham for short. She's just arrived. My life goes on. I live in the country. I live, as you can see, in a tiny cabin. I will go on living in the tiny cabin. It's on an island the size of a mattress. It's in the mountains. But one thing has changed. I am going to dedicate myself to somehow figuring out a way for the women who don't have my platform to hold men accountable. And Robbie and I are going to put our heads together. We both are getting these letters. We've said we're going to figure out a way. David, that's how my life is going to change. I'm a crone. I'm an elderly woman on a mountaintop. But I think we've got a few good years left to figure out a way to bring, well, to end the culture of sexual violence. That's what I want to do.
Ejin Carroll had a long career as a journalist, and she just filed an amended complaint in her lawsuit against former President Donald Trump. Roberta Kaplan is her attorney. You can read our coverage of the suit at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Little Mermaid, a remake of the animated classic that's now using live actors, opens this weekend. A remake like this is not without all kinds of risks. The underwater musical sequences have to convince us that they're real. Generations of fans grew up on the 1989 original, and they'll hold it to some very high standards. And ever since the singer and actress Halle Bailey was announced as the new Ariel, there's been a racist backlash from a small but loud chorus on social media, and it feels all too familiar.
While it's got a lot of fans, it is also being attacked by some internet trolls.
Actress Halle Bailey stars as Ariel in Disney's new live-action film, and she looks nothing like the animated Little Mermaid with red hair from the original 1989 classic. Then there are the ugly, racist tweets. The Little Mermaid is white, not black.
Nomi Fry covers pop culture for The New Yorker, and she talked about The Little Mermaid the other day with its director, Rob Marshall. Now, Marshall is not your typical blockbuster director. He began his career as a dancer on Broadway, but he was injured while performing in Cats. So he eventually turned to filmmaking. Since then, Marshall has directed Chicago, which 20 years ago won the Oscar for Best Picture, and he's made ambitious musical films like Into the Woods and Mary Poppins Returns. Here's Rob Marshall talking with Nomi Fry.
Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, Nomi. Lovely to be here.
Yeah. Seems like such a monumental achievement to even like approach this text and bring it to the screen in the way that you have. And I guess I'll start by asking, what was your relationship with The Little Mermaid before, you know, starting this project? Were you a fan? Did you have any thoughts about it or associations?
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny. In 1989, when the film came out, the animated film, I was doing Broadway. And I remember the whole Broadway community was so excited that this film was coming out because it was really the return of the musical to the screen. Even though it was animated, you know, there was like a proper score.
Life under the sea is better.
People actually singing.
They got going on up there. This seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. You dream about going up there, but that is a big mistake. Just look at the world.
I mean, musicals were dead at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were so excited. I was so thrilled to see it in the theater. And I remember later, years later, when I did the film Chicago,
mm-hmm.
It felt like, you know, that was sort of pushing the door open for live-action musicals. But in a way, it all started with this Little Mermaid in 1989, because it was really a resurgence of musicals on film.
Down here, all the fish is happy as off through the waves they roll. The fish on the land ain't happy.
You think about all those incredible films like Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, all those musicals, original musicals for film that came. And, you know, so I've always had like a connection to it, feeling like it opened the door for me and
that's so interesting to think about. I guess I, you know, not being part of the Broadway community, I've never thought about it in that way. You know,
yeah.
For me, it was just like a beloved Disney, you know,
yeah.
animated movie. But it does have that component of being a full-on musical.
It was, and it's on screen. So that was the connection to it. And then you know, musicals for me, like my first movie that I ever saw was Mary Poppins. You know, but there was Oliver and mm-hmm. My Fair Lady and Sound of Music. And, you know, those movies just shaped me as a young child.
Mm-hmm.
So I always, you know, I mean, literally, I was always dancing around my house, literally around the living room.
Yeah.
Literally, one time I was like dancing from couch to chair to couch to chair and landed on the coffee table and broke it.
Oh, good.
So that was not good.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just, if it's in you, it's in you. It's
yeah.
you know, you somehow, you catch the bug and it's part of you, you know?
Was it an immediate yes from you when they came?
No, actually,
okay.
It wasn't.
Okay.
I mean, in fact, I think we might have turned it down twice.
Huh. Interesting.
Well, because we thought, well, how do you do that?
Yeah.
And I was also concerned about a remake. I really didn't want to do a frame-by-frame remake of something,
mm-hmm.
but they were excited about us reimagining it
mm-hmm.
and looking at it from another angle. And I have to say, for me, I went back to the Hans Christian Andersen tale.
Interesting.
That really helped me because I
okay.
saw in that a very modern story. It's really mm-hmm. timeless
mm-hmm.
about a young girl who feels displaced,
yeah.
doesn't feel she belongs. And, you know, really embarks on a journey of self-discovery and also breaking down the barriers and walls between herself, her world, and the other world.
Mm-hmm.
Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete?
And so it was really about prejudice and breaking down those barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt, wow, isn't that the world we live in? I mean, for me, the whole time I was doing this movie, it felt really like an antidote to the times we're living in. I mean, the divisive world we live in. So I got excited about the idea of the story and of this movie. And then it was really like, how do you do it, though?
Exactly.
How do you do
and
it?
And so what was the first, I mean, for me watching it, and I imagine for a lot of lay people watching it who aren't, you know, knowledgeable about exactly how CGI works and how thinking about directing and doing choreography mm-hmm. and singing mm-hmm. Kind of vis-a-vis these new technologies,
mm-hmm.
what is the first step when you approach a project like
wow,
this?
Wow, such a good question. I mean, the first thing we did really was realize that we had to do all of the underwater work in a blue screen stage because you can't,
okay.
we can't use actual water because people mm-hmm. are singing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
right.
Yeah.
And speaking.
Bubble City,
and,
right.
you know, so
mm-hmm.
it doesn't work like that. So we had to create that environment. But what I realized was, you know, we had to be weightless. People had to be able to fly around and move and swim. I mean, that was the whole idea. So,
right.
and
exactly.
I realized that the way to start would be the sort of the conventional way, which is storyboarding. So you storyboard mm-hmm. the scene, like this is how it should be. That
mm-hmm.
moved into something called animatics, which
okay.
is like a live storyboard, like a moving storyboard. And then we moved into something called pre-visualization, which is almost like a little mini movie, little mini
huh.
animated movie. So you have this all planned out prior, and that took months and months and months and months and months.
And this is all digital, or does it
yes,
involve
all,
any live
not
actors
yet,
in
not
capacity?
Yet.
Okay.
So it's really just the shape, because what we had to do is we had to communicate what the scene would be to the stunt teams
mm-hmm.
and to our production designer, costume designer, and cinematographer, you know, how we're going to move the camera, how we're going to move the actors around.
Right.
So each literally in a scene, as an example, in a scene, I would say action eventually, and the actors would be on one sort of rig, and they would do a couple lines, and I'd say cut. Now we'd have to put them on another rig to do that move.
Wow.
So it was like literally shot in pieces. I mean, the goal for me is that when you see the film, you're unaware of any kind of...
Sure, it's seamless.
Seamless.
Yeah.
And also, what's there that's real are the people. But
of
what's
course.
Not real is, I mean, the CGI elements is everything around them. So the water, the vegetation, the fish, all of those things, the whole world around them, that's completely digital, as is their hair. They all had wig caps. They all had to wear wig caps because the hair is moving. And then
I was going to ask about the hair.
Yes. And then even Ariel's costume is all digital. Now, of course, we built it so that when she's on land, you see it. But underwater, it was just, I guess Javier Bardem as Triton had his armor. So that was truly real.
Right.
And, Melissa McCarthy as Ursula, her top, a lot of that was real.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, it was all creative. But that's why the movie took 4.5 years, because the post-production on this took 2 years.
Right.
And, you know, I was relentless about the look of it because it had to be, you had to believe. I mean, for me, as soon as I'm in a film and I see some CGI work that I feel is just so artificial, I feel,
Can you tell? Is that something that...
I can, unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, I try not to. I just want to sort of live in the world. But when it pulls you out, it's not good. The funny thing about musicals for me in general is, you know, a musical, especially a musical film, can go off the rails in 2 seconds because there's that moment when someone starts to sing where it either feels organic and earned and real, or it feels completely embarrassing.
Oh, totally. You know? Yeah, because there's a moment, it's a moment of artifice. It's like, oh, suddenly you're singing?
Yes.
Like, what's happening?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it only works when it feels like an extension of the scene in some way. Like, they can't, like, words aren't enough so you sing, or a movement's not enough so you dance. And it should feel seamless and organic. And that's always been the goal.
Yeah.
And I'm always aware of that when I'm working on a movie, especially because it's such a real genre. You know, you're sitting in the movie. It's different in a theater. You're in a theater and it feels artificial already. So when someone sings, it doesn't feel it's too strange. But movies are so realistic that you have to be so careful about how that first moment happens in the, you know, when the first moment of singing happens. I mean, in our film, Ariel sings Part of Your World. That's the first musical number in the movie. Yeah. It's 15 minutes in.
It's 15, right. It takes a while because I was watching and I was like, okay, I know this movie is supposed to be a musical, but I was like, oh, she's singing. It's been a while since the beginning.
Yes,
it does take a little bit.
It does. Well, you know, it's every musical has their own sort of shape.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of the shape of that, because that song is literally like our version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an I want song. And it's what begins the motor of the whole piece.
Mm-hmm.
What's her goal? What does she want?
Mm-hmm.
When people talk about I want songs, they always reference Part of Your World or Somewhere Over the Rainbow. You know, that's what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wanted to create at the beginning, I wanted to create a real world above on the ship. I wanted to make sure that you were inside the story and believed it before we're sort of asking people to hear someone sing. And it's what I love about Part of Your World is that it's just her thoughts. It's an extension of what she's feeling, and she's speaking to Flounder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't understand why, you know, those people up there, you know, why we should be afraid of them.
Yeah.
If you know, because she's collecting all these beautiful things, you know, they make all these beautiful things. I don't believe they can be that bad, you know, and I feel like, wow, I mean, that she has that moment, she can actually sing it, and it can come from her, in, almost like an internal monologue coming out of her, you know?
Yeah.
And the goal is that by the time she sings, you're ready for that. You know, you feel ready, and now you're
that
ready, and you can embrace a musical.
Mm-hmm.
Betcha on land, they understand. Bet they don't reprimand their daughters, bright young women. Sick of foremen, ready to stand. Ready to know what the people know.
that obviously also touches on all of these questions of kind of cultural, you know, the complaints that because, you know, Halle Bailey is a woman of color,
yes,
and, you know, this is a very diverse version of the story, adaptation of the story. There was kind of backlash that this is like, oh, it's too woke, you know, like they're doing, Disney is going woke, you know, all of that talk.
Yes. Well, it's ironic. I'll tell you why. There was zero agenda.
Interesting. Okay.
So when we went to cast the role of Ariel,
mm-hmm,
it was, let's find the best person for the role,
mm-hmm,
period. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
We saw everybody. We saw every ethnicity. We just looked for the best person.
Mm-hmm.
And Halle came in. She sang Part of Your World. It was so moving, so touching, so deep. And then she read for us, and she was 18 when she came in for us.
Wow, that's,
she's 23 now, so that's the,
right,
that's
how
the
long
length,
it took,
right?
Yeah.
And she was otherworldly. And when people see the film, they'll see she's Ariel. I never thought once about skin color.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I will say it was my intention to make the sisters the daughters of the seven seas, because I really wanted to lean into the mythology of Triton and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, mm-hmm, here we are. We have seven of these, you know, mm-hmm, mermaids. So let's make them the daughters of the seven seas. So that was fun. But it was never sort of like, let's do a woke version of Little Mermaid.
Sure.
It was, let's just do the best version of Little Mermaid. And I hope, you know, to me, this whole controversy in a way feels archaic. I mean, like from another century, you know.
Totally.
I mean, I did Cinderella,
mm-hmm,
as a choreographer in 1997. That,
mm-hmm,
with Brandy playing Cinderella.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
And
of
remember
course,
that with,
yeah,
Whoopi and
with
fabulous cast and Whitney Houston.
Yeah,
and it was a colorblind casting, and it, mm-hmm, was sort of you know, I don't know, new at that time.
Yeah,
but that was 1997.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks so much, Rob.
No,
thank
this
you.
Has been a pleasure.
This has been so nice.
Rob Marshall is the director of Disney's new Little Mermaid, and he spoke with Nomi Fry, a staff writer at The New Yorker.
Look at the sun and the sky and the sand and the sea behind me. Look at me.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Don't mind me as I climb for the first time. Jump for the first time. Trying to stand, but this gravity's pulling me down.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
All right, sorry about that. We've got so many people here that I think we are kind of melting the servers.
See, I think we're back online here.
I am running for president of the United States to lead our great American comeback.
Despite some very embarrassing technical difficulties on Twitter, Ron DeSantis finally declared his candidacy for president. And he enters the race with an enormous war chest and name recognition, but he's also the object of daily rage from a familiar corner, Mar-a-Lago. Donald Trump refers to DeSantis, of course, as DeSanctimonious, and a lot worse. Welcome to the 2024 campaign. DeSantis gained attention nationally during COVID, when Florida refused many of the recommended public health measures. And since then, he's been pursuing political vendettas seemingly designed to keep him in the headlines. Last fall, he chartered planes to fly migrants to the wealthy beach community of Martha's Vineyard. And he's embroiled in a titanic legal battle with the Disney Corporation and its CEO, Bob Iger. Staff writer Dexter Filkins profiled Ron DeSantis in The New Yorker as his presidential ambitions were becoming quite clear. I talked with Dexter last year. Well, let's talk a little bit about his background. Who is Ron DeSantis? Where does he come from? What kind of person is he?
He's from Florida. He was born in Jacksonville. He grew up outside of Tampa in a town called Dunedin. And it's a working class neighborhood. Working class guy, went to public school. He was a great baseball player in Little League, where they won the World Series, and in high school. And he went to Yale on a baseball scholarship and then on to Harvard Law School. So he's come a long way.
Did he distinguish himself academically at Yale and then Harvard Law?
He did. He did. In fact, one of the more funny quotes that I got from one of his former classmates at Yale was, "Ron was so smart that we couldn't plagiarize off of his papers because everyone would know where it came from because he's the only one that smart who could have made that argument."
He's smart in what way?
More than a couple of people told me, his memory is practically photographic, and particularly when I was having conversations about the coronavirus, that he was reading medical journals, and he'd read them once, he would digest it, he would understand it, and could have a conversation about it. Like, he's very, very fast.
How would you describe Ron DeSantis ideologically, and how did he become that way?
It's hard to tell how much of Ron DeSantis is ideological and how much is opportunism. He sounds like Trump, except that he speaks in complete sentences. And he's very, very articulate and very, very quick. But he's competing for the same constituency. So he's very, very angry at the elites, even though he went to Harvard and Yale. He's very angry at Washington. He's very angry at the politicians. And so he's kind of rallying basically the white working class of Florida, of which the numbers are still quite large. And he's angry.
And we're going to make sure that parents are able to send their kid to kindergarten without having some of this stuff injected into their school curriculum.
How did he become governor? My understanding is that although he's now seen as the dominant political figure in state politics, obviously Trump himself is in Palm Beach, that DeSantis really kind of, he squeaked by to get in.
He squeaked by. He did. I think he won by less than 1%. And I think there was at least one recount, automatic recount. He defeated a politician named Andrew Gillum, who had been the mayor of Tallahassee. Very, very close race. And I think he benefited from the fact that Gillum, not only was he black in a state, former Confederacy, but also because Gillum came from the left of the party. And Gillum had squeaked in and sort of beaten a moderate to get the nomination against Gwen Graham, who many people believed would have fared much better against DeSantis. But DeSantis won just by a hair, but he's been a missile going straight up ever since.
What do you mean?
He has developed a style which is very visible, very theatrical, again, very angry, but it has made him a national politician. And he really built, over the last couple of years, he really built himself and his persona, and I hate to use the word brand, but it's a brand, around the way that he dealt with the coronavirus. And essentially, it played in perfectly for him and his style, because he could say, I don't agree with Fauci and all the pinheads in Washington, and all they want to do is oppress you and make you wear masks and keep your children at home. And so he charted this very, very novel course on the coronavirus, and that's what made him famous.
Now, the COVID policy that you describe is not just, you know, sheer obstinate ignorance. We've seen some of that in political quarters in the last few years, but something a little bit more complicated.
I had a long conversation with a professor at Stanford of public health, an epidemiologist named Jay Bhattacharya, who said he was sitting at home one day on a Sunday, and his phone rang, and it was Ron DeSantis, and he wanted to talk about the coronavirus. And Bhattacharya, very, very much like DeSantis, were kind of charting a slightly different course. And basically, and I'm going to make this a little crude, but it's essentially masking doesn't really work. The only thing you can really do is protect the elderly, which DeSantis did from the get-go, protect the elderly and basically try to ride the virus out until a vaccine comes. But don't kid yourself, there's not that much that we can do about it. And so what followed from that, naturally, was keep the schools open, keep the government offices open, keep the beaches open, keep the shopping malls open, and that's what Florida did. Very, very different from, say, New York or California.
And so I think the question is we can either have a free society or we can have a biomedical security state. And I can tell you, Florida, we're a free state.
And how are its statistics?
That's very, very interesting. I mean, kind of, you know, they went up and down and up and down, and he caught a lot of hell over the course of the pandemic. But the numbers aren't bad. I mean, he's kind of, Florida is in the middle when you look at death rates. It's pretty much in the middle of the pack, right next to California. So, you know, California shut down their entire economy, all their schools for 2 years. Florida kept everything open. So he's looking better than he did.
Now, another issue that's been crucial to his presence on the national scene is LGBTQ issues and how they're taught in schools. DeSantis has been out front on that. He passed a law a couple of months ago called the Parental Rights in Education, or the so-called Don't Say Gay law, where he supported it. What's the deal there? Tell me what happened and what role DeSantis plays there.
Well, I think, again, DeSantis has become a master at picking these issues that get everyone excited.
Hot button cultural issues.
Super hot button, yeah. And he's very, very good at sort of staking out a position and kind of pounding the table and saying, I'm not giving in to the liberals in the Northeast.
One of the stunning things about this episode is that DeSantis goes to war against a huge company in a state, against Disney.
It's remarkable. And he appears not to have suffered for it politically, not yet.
So describe the fight and what was the outcome?
So they hate it when you say the Don't Say Gay law, but that's how everybody understands it now, so I'm going to use that. The legislature passes the law. He signs it. Disney's response initially in Orlando, Disney World, is tepid. And the employees, many employees at Disney World, got angry at their CEO and said, this isn't enough. Like, we hate this. And so then the CEO came forward and condemned DeSantis and condemned the law. And then DeSantis basically went after Disney. And, you know, Disney, since it was built in the late 1960s, has basically had its own, basically it governs itself. If there's a fire at Disney World, Disney World has to put out the fire.
And they have special accommodations in some ways.
Yeah, very. And they govern themselves, essentially. They are left alone. And DeSantis just took that and threatened to zero out the entire special district for Disney World. And when you talk to ordinary, say, ordinary voters or people, his supporters, that's what they love about him. You know, they would say, you know, any other politician would have caved into Disney. You know, would have backed down and said, I'm so sorry, and not Ron.
So what's the purpose of the law in the first place?
I hate to speculate as to his motives, but it made a lot of headlines all across the country. And I think just the kind of headlines that he wants to make.
Which are what?
Which is, when you see him speak, he says, I'm anti-woke, I'm anti-elites, I'm against the press, I'm against the pinhead politicians in Washington. And so he can position himself as very much as a kind of anti-elitist. He doesn't really need to do all that in Florida to win. I mean, he's got that constituency locked up anyway.
So it's all national politics.
That's what it seems like. I mean, I think every person I talk to who knows him says this is a deeply ambitious man, and he's had his eyes on the White House since he was in college, and that every job he had was basically a stepping stone to the next one.
So you knocked on a lot of doors in the state of Florida in pursuit of a really deep piece on Ron DeSantis. One of the doors you knocked on was on the door of the father of Ron DeSantis. Describe that encounter.
Well, you know, I had just come from the CPAC conference in Orlando where Ron Jr. spoke, pounding the table. And I thought
it's the Conservative Political Action Committee.
Yeah. It's the big gathering. And so I drove to Dunedin, the little town where they still live. I looked up his address. He was there. I pulled over into a McDonald's and, like, changed into put out, like, a white shirt on and long pants. And I went with absolutely no expectation of success. I went and knocked on the door. And it's a...
As we learned to do as young reporters many years ago.
Yeah, you think, there's no way he's going to come out and talk to me. He probably won't even be there. And lo and behold, he did. And he was wearing an FSU t-shirt, looked like he hadn't shaved in a couple of days, barefoot, shorts, nicest guy in the world. I mean, absolutely, really nice. Didn't really want to talk to me at first, said I'm a little suspicious, I'll be frank with you. But then we had a really nice talk about his son.
How did he characterize him?
He said more than once, he said, well, Ron is stubborn. And he told a very funny story about him, which was, Ron's a very good baseball player. And my gosh, I must have thrown 500,000 pitches to him when he was young, right out there in the front yard. And I think he only swung at 500 of them.
He likes to walk. Well, and Fox has had a huge role in DeSantis's ascent. You did a public records request and got a lot of emails between Fox News and DeSantis's office. What did you learn from those emails?
It's pretty amazing. It's basically a symbiotic relationship. It's kind of, DeSantis needs Fox to become a national figure. Fox needs somebody to replace Trump. They kind of find each other. And so... over the course of the emails, they're each suggesting programs to the other. They're practically writing the questions for each other. They're saying, God, that was great. You know, we should make you a host of our show. And so it is so close that, the idea of kind of the traditional idea of journalism, which is you keep your distance. Journalists keep their distance from politicians. I mean, that's all gone.
Not so much.
Yeah.
And what's been the impact of his appearances on Fox? Is it quantifiable?
I think so. It's quantifiable in the polls, which are he is now far ahead of any other potential Republican nominee for the presidential election. And I think that's with the exception of Trump.
What is that relationship like?
As I was told, Trump believes, with some justification, that he created DeSantis. He endorsed him during the primary, and DeSantis, who had been far behind, kind of just took off and won the nomination. And so I think former President Trump expects a little bit of deference and a little bit more gratitude than he's been getting from DeSantis. As somebody put it to me, Ron refuses to kiss his ring.
Or anything else. Dexter, thank you.
Thanks, David.
Staff writer Dexter Filkins. His 2022 profile of Ron DeSantis is at NewYorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. I hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Brita Green, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, Avery Keatley, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline, Michael May, David Gable, and Meher Bhatia. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.